The Guardian.
Hello, this is The Guardian Football Weekly, in association with Yossimar. Today, we're going to talk about FIFA under Gianni Infantino. In February 2016, he became the FIFA president. He took over an organization described by the US Justice Department as blighted by rampant, systemic, and deep-rooted corruption. As Infantino said himself at the FIFA Compliance Summit last year, FIFA in 2015 was itself almost irreparably damaged.
What was FIFA before? Well, FIFA in 2015, the old FIFA was, let's face it, a toxic organization, an organization which was clinically dead, where those whose job was to help football grow instead helped their own bank accounts grow, and the bank accounts accessorily of their friends.
Mr. Infantino promised to make big changes to what had gone before, and he says he has.
I think that FIFA, to take an analogy with the pandemic, FIFA went through its own pandemic back in 2015. And so we have been able to elaborate and to develop our own vaccines and our own immunity.
So is he right? Has FIFA reformed its governance? Has Gianni Infantino changed things? And why does it matter? In today's episode of The Guardian Football Weekly, we speak to Miguel Maduro, a man made chairman of the Independent Governance Committee in 2016 and a man stripped of that role 8 months later. Does he believe that FIFA is what Gianni Infantino says it is? This is The Guardian Football Weekly. Joining me for this podcast, Philippe Auclair. Hey, Philippe.
Good morning, afternoon, evening to you, Max, wherever you are.
Hello, Tariq Panja from The New York Times.
Morning, Max.
So, this is really interesting. It's complicated. This won't be the first time I tell listeners, you know, to perhaps concentrate more than you normally do on our podcast. And I guess as a football fan, I want to think and I want to know that good people are running the game in the right way. And I'm very interested to find out if that is true or not. I'm not looking at you yet, Philippe. So look, before we play out this interview, I think there's a few questions for me and perhaps listeners who are equally, probably not as uninformed as me, but at that level compared to where the two of you are. Miguel Maduro, who we'll hear from, was the chairman of the FIFA Governance Committee and its independent review committee. He was appointed in 2016 and he was in office for 8 months before he was removed. He has a pretty good CV. He was Advocate General at the European Court of Justice in Luxembourg from 2003 to 2009. He's a Portuguese academic and politician, the Portuguese Minister for Regional Development for 2 years from 2013, the Director of the Global Governance Programme, a Professor of Law at the European University Institute in Florence. He was a visiting professor at the Faculty of Law at Yale University. Philippe, why was his appointment by Infantino important?
It was important as it appeared to send a very, very strong signal, because his appointment and the appointment of several figures, by the way, in the independent committees at the time was welcome as a sign that this time FIFA really meant business. And because his reputation was impeccable, was pristine, really. And you got the feeling that you would have somebody who was independently minded and also of such a stature that it would give credence to the reform process which had been initiated by Gianni Infantino. So it was a very important move. And I have to say that for a while, certainly as long as Miguel Maduro had this position, it genuinely seemed that some things were happening which were going in the right way, particularly when I think it demonstrated his independence and the independence of his committee when he basically barred a very, very powerful man indeed, Vitaly Mutko, the Russian minister, friend of Putin, who was also linked to the organization of the 2018 World Cup and so forth. And he barred Mr. Mutko from office in the FIFA Executive Council. So he applied the criteria extremely rigorously. And for these reasons, Miguel Maduro and his team were welcome, I think, by the football world at large. as people who could be perhaps the, well, start the renewal process that we had been promised.
Philip, remind us who Josimar are. They're, this is a sort of a co-production, I guess.
Well, Josimar are a Norwegian publication, which at the beginning was, I suppose, a bit of a hipster magazine, not unlike the Blizzard or Panenka and other magazines of that kind, but which has developed a reputation over the past few years for its investigations. And Josimar basically has now become, I hope, since I am a collaborator of theirs, a place where you do have very hard questions put to the world of football, particularly in terms of governance. This is where they are at. It's a small but I hope not insignificant force for good in football, Max. Nothing less than that.
So we get your journalistic expertise. You get our listeners and a happy idiot like me asking very basic questions. And it's a marriage made in heaven, isn't it? Right. So let's play out the interview that we did with Miguel Maduro. It does mention things like governance committees, which on the face of it aren't tremendously exciting, but they do matter. It does also mention coloured pens. So like that's something that I could really understand. Here's our interview, and then we'll reflect on it and hear FIFA's response after this. Our listeners are really interested in this sort of subject, but we normally deliver them kind of vague analysis on whether Jose Mourinho is happy or not. So
is he ever happy? Have you ever seen him happy anywhere?
I think, well, once in 2010 or something. So Miguel, I'll ask some very simple questions, and I'll blame the audience on them being so simple, but it's really for me. Tarek Panja and Philippe Auclair will probably correct me along the way. And I guess we just really want to hear your story, how you came to become the chair of FIFA's Independent Governance Committee in 2016, what you found when you got there, and how you came to no longer being chair of FIFA's Independent Governance Committee 8 months later. Does that sound reasonable?
Yes, absolutely. I'm very happy to talk with you on all of those issues.
Okay, so let's start at the beginning then. Did FIFA approach you, or did you approach them? How do you end up in that role?
So FIFA approached me. I think not divulging anything confidential when I tell you that I had not exactly work, but I had provided some advice actually on a pro bono basis to UEFA when they were setting up their financial fair play system and on the need to make it compatible with EU rules, and also even suggesting some names to be in the panel and in the appellate, the adjudicative body and the investigative body of the financial fair play system. And at that point, I got to know relatively well Alistair Bell. So it was actually Alistair Bell that a few years later basically contacted me and asked me if I will be open to talk with the new president of FIFA, Infantino, and consider taking up the job as chair of the governance committee. And I did, and I accepted to do it. I had a commitment on his part that they would accept and that they will, the other members that will be independent members of the board were people of quality. And so I was told some of those names. And I was confident that the group of people at that time in the governance and review committee was a good group of people.
So when they called you, did they kind of say, look, FIFA hasn't necessarily got everything right in the past, and we'd quite like to get some things right in the future?
They basically told me that they were aware of how bad things had been taking place in the past, that they wanted a clean cut with the practices of the past, and that they wanted credible people and people that were not connected with the football organizations in the past, as was my case, and it was the case with most people that went to the governance and review committee. And it was in that context that I said yes. I actually genuinely, naively too, then I understood, thought that they really wanted to change the culture of the organization, and that we will be allowed to really undertake our job fully independent in enforcing the rules. I then discovered that was not exactly the case. We did try to do things as diplomatic as possible. That's the reason why, for example, we developed notes with the criteria for eligibility for the integrity tests, for fit and proper tests that we developed, and we made it public. But that was what it meant for us, to be diplomatic and to take into account the dominant culture in the world of football organizations. That was to be pedagogical, to try to reason with them, but it didn't meant for us to in any way bind the rules, or even worse, as basically I think that that's their tradition and what they were expecting, to selective apply the rules. The fact that ultimately led to my departure and that those of the colleagues that then followed me, it was the fact that we wanted the rules to be applied the same way, independently of the power and the importance of the people in question.
So explain sort of practically how that works. Are you looking at everything that FIFA is doing on a sort of minute by minute basis and then ringing Infantino up and going, no, that's not independent? Like, how does it work?
No. So the governance and review committees, there were two committees, but basically let's talk about the governance committee, because the governance committee included the sub review committee. And so it did basically three things. One of the most important was to do fit and proper tests, so eligibility tests. See if the persons that were either running for positions in the FIFA Council or the Confederation, the leading positions on the Confederations, or that were being appointed for FIFA committees, had integrity problems, and there was a fit and proper test to be applied, and that was one of the things that we applied, and that generated multiple conflicts and problems for us. The second issue, and that was also a major source of conflict with some of the powerful confederations and with the FIFA leadership, was we had the task of supervising the elections. There's a rule in the FIFA governance regulations that basically attributes to the governance committee the role of supervising that the elections take place into accordance with the FIFA statutes. And that means, for example, that they need to be free and fair elections. So we had the role of supervising that, and that was another major task. And the third task was that of making proposals. So that's where we will look at the general problems that we will envision and make. So for example, the FIFA human rights policy was proposed by us to the council to be adopted, okay? But even there, where we had only the right to make proposals, but we had the specific right to make proposals, the practice of the institution got in tension with us, because the way they saw it was that their administration prepares the policies, everything else, and then we will sign up to them. And I told them, no way that's going to be the case. We have a right to make proposals. We independently, we consult with you, but the proposal comes from us. No one in the culture of the institution expects independent committees to be independent. And therefore, if everyone throughout the organization of football also reads the decisions of the independent committees as actually decisions that ultimately fit what the leadership wants. And so that creates a kind of circular and vicious cycle, whereby the leadership knows that whatever the independent committees will be attributed to them, and so it creates a stronger incentive for them to interfere and try to control the independent committees.
Can I ask a couple of specific things? You talked about sort of the transparency of elections, and within FIFA, like anonymity for the people voting. But can you tell us about the coloured pens? This is an amazing story.
No, so since we had that task and we immediately had to supervise some elections, we inquire and interview several people to try to find out what were the main problems in terms of vote control, and what were the main instruments in terms of vote control. We knew, even because of corruption cases, that there was vote buying. We had no criminal investigation powers, so it was limited what we could do in that respect. But at least we could do something, that it was to limit the extent of voting control and to try to preserve the confidentiality of the vote and the integrity of the vote in all other respects. And we found out that there were mechanisms such as requiring those that vote to take photos with their smartphones to then demonstrate that they had voted according to what they had promised, or to use a particular colored pen. And then they will say, when you have a community of only 35 people voting, you will say, if there is no vote, ballot vote with this color pen, we know that you did not vote the way you were supposed to. So those are our two instruments. So we imposed a series of rules that will prohibit people from using their own pens, that will prohibit people from taking smartphones to the voting booths, what created immediately some controversy. And again, it was a source of tension for us.
So, for example, you know, let's say you're Gianni Infantino and you want me to vote for Philippe for something, but I vote for Tariq. I end up being given a red pen. So everybody looks at me and goes, he's got a red pen. So we know he voted for the person we didn't want him to.
I have to be careful in here. I do not know if Mr. Infantino himself did that in any way or not.
Okay.
I'm saying that that's one way that the control takes place.
That's amazing.
That takes place. I mean, it was one way that we discovered, but there are many other. In one of the confederations that we went, and I've spoken in a procedure about it, judicial procedure about this. In one of the confederations where we had this discrimination against women, when I had a discussion with the Electoral Commission about this case of discrimination, the president of the Electoral Commission, that the person supposed to control the integrity of the process, turned to me and said, no, we cannot, because I told them, look, you cannot proceed like this because you're discriminating against women. You have to open up all the positions to women participating. And then only if at the end, by the last one, there is no woman elected, then that one becomes reserved for women. But women need to be able to run for all the positions. And he turned to me and he said, no, we cannot do that because all positions have been decided already. This was before the elections. So this tells you the extent of voting control that goes on. And it's absolutely control the vote. Sometimes in order to make sure that the voting control actually is effective, they use some of those mechanisms.
Can you tell us about Vitaly Mutko? So he was formerly the Deputy Prime Minister of Russia, Minister of Sport. He was alleged to have overseen the vast doping programs before the 2012 London Olympics and the 2014 Sochi Olympics. And you ruled that he couldn't sit on FIFA's ruling council.
So in the case of Mr. Mutko was a case where we had to perform an eligibility check, an integrity test. And we had two issues that were on our plate with respect to him. One was the doping charges. But at the time, there was only the McLaren report, but we could not have access to the information on the McLaren report. So it would always have been complicated for us to do a specific assessment of the extent to which he was or not guilty of direct involvement on that. But we could have assessed the extent to which he had an objective responsibility, because even if he was not directly responsible, if that had not been demonstrated at the time, it could be said that since he was in charge of sport in Russia, he had some kind of objective responsibility. But we had another issue that ended up being the issue under which we decided, because it was a preliminary issue that preceded that assessment. That was the fact that, in our view, the rule in FIFA that requires FIFA officials to be neutral with respect to governmental organizations prevents government ministers, members of government, from taking up positions at FIFA. Unfortunately, this was not the past tradition of FIFA, and we considered that we had to put a stop to that, and that it was, of course, when we did this, the presidency and all the leadership of FIFA was extremely upset, and they pressured us in many different ways not to decide this way. Particularly arguing that it was extremely sensitive in light of the forthcoming World Cup in Russia.
How did that pressure manifest itself?
Well, different people, from the president himself writing to us and arguing that we were introducing a new rule because FIFA had never interpreted the principle of political neutrality in that way. And we said, no, we're not introducing a new rule. We are finally enforcing a rule that you've had for many years. The fact that it has never been enforced is no reason to continue not to enforce it. But then he asked many other people, such as the Secretary General herself and other people. I talked about that when I went to the UK Parliament, even presidents of independent committees to talk to me and try to convince me to in turn convince them, my colleagues, to decide differently, what I refused to do.
So you had time to upset quite a lot of people in a few months, Miguel. But well, obviously the question is, had you been taken on for a mission which had, in time, was like, okay, this is a one-year contract, this is a five-year contract, or it's roll on year and so forth. So what happened exactly, apart from the fact that you were regularly in delicate situations with the FIFA hierarchy, what actually led to the termination of your involvement with FIFA? Did they say, is it you who decided I want to go, or is it FIFA who said, I'm terribly sorry, we changed our mind, we need to find somebody else? How did that happen, and did they ever give you a reason for what happened?
My initial appointment was only for 1 year, basically. 10 months, in fact. But the idea was that was going to be renewed. I mean, I would never have accepted that they told me it was only for 10 months. And the president of FIFA actually told me that he expected me to remain in place for several mandates, including and 10 months, then four years, and then even to continue. When I was deciding Mr. Mutko and all the other cases, I knew that going against the president, I was increasing the likelihood that I will not stay in my position, in my chair. I discussed this even with some of my colleagues. But I actually expected that they will not even, that may not dare to do that, because I thought, I mean, their reputation cost will be such that they probably will not dare to do that. But I was wrong, obviously. They were, as someone at FIFA told me, well, it's one week of bad publicity and then it goes away. And they were absolutely right in that respect. And that's the way they see things. So what then happened is that after these decisions, this complicated decision, particularly after the Mutko decision, the president of FIFA stopped talking to me and stopped replying, never talked to me. I sent the proposal of the FIFA human rights policy, and I asked to go and present it in the FIFA Council, and he never replied on that. And then I was supposed to go to the Congress, where I was supposed to be reelected, and I was told one day before that they had decided not to put my name forth anymore, and that I was going to be replaced. That was it. And they never gave, the president himself did not tell me that. It was one of his advisors that called me. I never got any explanation on why that was the case.
Yeah, it was Miguel's arrival and departure were quite interesting from what I remember. There was a lot of drama. Miguel's arrival, I don't think you were there, were you, Miguel, when you were appointed in Mexico City? And then you were kicked out one day before when you were supposed to be in Bahrain. So I think it was less than a year in total because of these two things. Yes. And I remember when he arrived, you were actually used by Gianni Infantino, your name and your reputation. It was a press conference because he removed your predecessor. And
not my predecessor, because the governance committee did not exist. I think the problem is that...
Someone who had a similar role.
Not exactly, but he removed someone that was seen as independent from the audit.
Right. It was a Domenico Scala, the head of audit and compliance. There was a lot of noise that... He's removed this guy, and I remember the press conference, and everyone was saying, "Look, you said you're going to be a new broom, and you're going to do all the right things, and you've removed this guy who was the independent audit and compliance guy," and he took personal umbrage to that question by using Miguel's name, invoking Miguel's name in the press conference. Miguel was there in Mexico City, and he said, "How can you say that I'm not taking this seriously when I've appointed a man like Miguel Maduro, the Advocate General at the European Court of Justice?" And he used Miguel's reputation immediately to show that FIFA was on a better and a right track. You didn't just go. After you left, a lot of other independent members who have very good CVs also left, but then others stayed. So what does that tell you about those who stayed, what are their motivations? And those who went, because that raises questions in its own right, in my opinion.
most of the independent members left. And as to why some stay, I don't want to speculate myself on that, but I will just tell you, compare the CVs of those that left and those that stay. And that may tell you, may go a long way to tell you.
But Miguel, is there also a kind of, once you're in the club and it's really hard to leave. You might come with good intentions like some of these people, but you're at the World Cup final. I use this, I've written about this so I can say this publicly. Your predecessor, the person who followed you. I remember being in Russia at the hotel, I think it was the Lot in Moscow, where the FIFA council was staying. So what I found strange was this 5-star hotel where the FIFA council was staying, it also housed the head of the Independent Ethics Committee, Maria Claudia Rojas, you're the guy from the governance, Mukul Mukdal. And if these are the independent guys and they're so close to power, they're in the same 5-star hotels as them and they're going to the games, you don't want to rock the boat, because if you know you're going to rock the boat, you're going to be out. And if you don't, you have this lifestyle. And I remember, and I'm going to say it because I've written it, I remember Mr. Mukdal in the hotel, and again, nothing wrong with it if that's what they've given him, but he was confirming that he had a suite and not a normal room. Now, if that is the head of the governance committee, the oversight committee, being kept in this 5-star hotel suite in one of the best hotels in Moscow, I'm sure part of him, or part of anyone, it's human nature maybe, would say, well, I can get used to this. This kind of perks and grace and favour type of lifestyle, is that also how FIFA and IOC or any other organisations manage to co-opt members, be they independent or council members, from just sort of going with the flow?
For me, the fundamental problem is not necessarily that he's staying in that hotel. The fundamental problem is that in order for him to continue to stay in that hotel, he needs to do what they want him to do. So that's why they argued that the independent committee should have one full term, that they should not be able to be fired once elected, and that they cannot be subject to renewal, because that will make him totally independent. That will mean that the variety of perks that you get in that position, including being extremely well paid, will not depend on you continuing to satisfy those in a position of power. The problem is therefore that this systemic conflict of interest that makes those that are supposed to control those in power to depend on those in power. And this is what is unacceptable, and that's what undermines the independence of these committees. And the only way you can break this vicious cycle is by creating a set of institutional rules that make them genuinely independent, as I said, the rules I was talking about. Just one other point on something that Tariq was saying before. Another crucial problem is what he was mentioning in terms of, this is a club, a closed club, okay? Those in power in the world of football are always the same. If you say they stay in power for many years, they are replaced by those that are close to them. And this is a fundamental problem that diminishes the degree of scrutiny, and also diminishes degree of democracy and inclusiveness in the world of football.
Finally, Miguel, do you think FIFA cares about football fans?
I think they need to care. Because it's their market, it's where their money comes, and the money is what gives them the power, and the power is what gives them the money. So they care, they need to care in maintaining the game credible and maintaining the fans to support the game. What they have detected is that the elasticity of fans' support for the game is enough for fans not to care, not to understand about the governance problems. And to the extent that fans don't realize, it's the problem that we saw before. If the public opinion doesn't mobilize really and doesn't link the instances and the cases of corruption with the systemic problems in the organization of football, the systemic problems will remain, because there is no incentive for them to reform them. If the fans will stop seeing the matches because they will be too shocked, too upset with the degree of systemic corruption and with the governance problems in the world of football, then they will have an incentive to reform. But that has not happened so far. And that's one of the reasons why reform hasn't happened from within. And that's the reason why I believe that reform will only happen if it will be imposed from the outside.
And why should fans care? I imagine most fans are like, I do care about this on a kind of distant level, but I'm desperate to get back in the ground as soon as the pandemic's done. I want to see my team.
Sure. But, I mean, fans should care whenever you have a system of selective enforcement of rules, because means your team will never be playing necessarily with the same rules in the system that others will be playing. And there is the risk of that. That's the first reason that fans should care. Fans should care because this system is reducing, is responsible for the extreme high reduction of competitiveness in football. And it's destroying many national leagues, particularly medium-sized and small leagues. And fans should care because they are also citizens. A lot of money that is linked to money laundering activities, to corruption, to tax evasion, is now money that is related to football activities. And as citizens, we should care to make sure that the mechanisms of governance of football are such that allow us to, as much as possible, prevent that use of football for those unlawful purposes. And that will also facilitate identifying and prosecuting instances of tax evasion, of corruption, of money laundering that are related to football activities. And as long as the governance structures of football are not transparent, don't have appropriate mechanisms of checks and balances, that makes it much harder to identify those cases.
Is your life easier now you don't have to send emails to Gianni Infantino that he doesn't reply to?
It's not easy. I make my life harder in other ways. I always get, but not necessarily with football. My interest in football remains very active. I remain, on the one hand, as an academic and as someone that speaks publicly, engaged in trying to change this with very small expectation that I will be successful. But I remain engaged in trying to change the way football organizes itself and the governance of football. And I remain very engaged as a football fan. I'm a fan of Sporting Club of Portugal, a passionate fan of the club, and I remain engaged in that way. What tells you the extent even someone that is so skeptical about the organizations of football manages to remain so passionate about football and his team. The passion of it is higher than my rational understanding of the football as an organization and as the governance mechanism.
Miguel, listen, thanks so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Thanks so much to all of you. Thank you.
Welcome back to the Guardian Football Weekly. So we reached out to FIFA with the allegations made in that interview with Miguel. A spokesperson told us that since 2016 and the arrival of the new leadership, deep-rooted governance reforms have been implemented at the organisation. They wanted to point out that many people serving on FIFA's independent committees have held the highest and most respected positions across the six continents, including the former president of the European Court of Justice, the former president of the Colombian Council of State, and the former chief justice of the Indian High Court. They told us, this is a quote, "We think it is unfair for Mr. Maduro to imply or suggest that all the qualified people left FIFA at the same time he did, because that is not the case. With regards to benefits and compensation, FIFA told us they have implemented clear regulations that apply to members of the independent committees, including to Maduro when he was chairman of the governance committee. FIFA also wants to point out that since 2016, they believe the organization has made massive strides to improve transparency. They told us that, quote, in this respect, the comparison between the FIFA of the Sepp Blatter era and the new FIFA is night and day. Progress that they say Miguel Maduro fails to recognize or acknowledge. Finally, they told us that, quote, in our view and in contrast to the impression given by Mr. Maduro, the facts demonstrate and confirm that FIFA has made enormous progress under its new leadership and that it is now in a positive place. At the same time, we are also humble enough to know and to acknowledge that the journey on governance for FIFA as a global football institution is far from over. We also reached out to Mukul Mukdal for comment as of recording, have not heard back. So, Philippe, what do you make of what Miguel said and what FIFA have said in response?
Oh, Max, thank you very much for this one. Max, I'm not sure that's the way to ask the question, because that's too wide in a way. Because what do I make? Well, I make that Miguel Maduro has given a very clear expose of what his time at the helm of FIFA was, and that FIFA is hiding behind the same kind of vocabulary that they've been hiding behind for all these years, and that there were some very strong, you can call them allegations, but statements by Miguel Maduro, which dealt with the actual governance and the facts of what happened when he was there, and also very importantly, the circumstances in which he was removed from office under pretenses which I think are not valid. This is my personal opinion, obviously. As to response of FIFA, the fact that the process has only started, well, yes, I certainly agree with that, because what I would say is that you judge or you form an opinion on what the governance committees are doing and on their independence by what they're doing. And what they've been doing since the removal of Miguel Maduro and others from these governance committees hasn't been, in my opinion, forthright in terms of showing that FIFA has indeed progressed. And there are numerous examples, I mean, some of which we will probably touch upon, which seem to indicate that the progress, certainly in terms of transparency, hasn't been that spectacular, to be honest. I don't know if that answers your question, Max, because reacting to a statement from a global body like FIFA, unless you want to pick up every thread and demonstrate that in your view, what they're saying doesn't hold, which would take us an awful long time. And we don't have an awful long time because we've still got to talk about VAR and Jose Mourinho not being very happy at the moment. this is about all I have to say, and I've probably spoken for too long already.
Tarek, do FIFA have a point about the people who've stayed and who haven't? You know, Miguel said in the interview, look, compare the CVs of those who left when he left and those that remain there.
Factually, yeah, they do have a point because they have those CVs. But we have to go back and look at Miguel and all those other people who also had good CVs and walked out. To me, it smacks again of FIFA sort of using these CVs as a bit of a shield whenever there's any criticism. And those guys, yes, they have great CVs, but, you know, one of the people that was referenced there, Miguel's replacement, is an Indian guy, Mukul Mukdal. And, you know, I happened to be in the hotel at the Russia World Cup where the FIFA executive or the council was staying, as were these independent members of their oversight committee, basically. Should they be in the same five-star hotel? I'm not so sure. Should they be there at all? And I guess I don't know how you would behave, Max, or I would behave. Once you're in, how do you behave? The issue might not be the individuals. It might be the system and the culture. And unfortunately, a lot of what happened previous to Infantino, the kind of lifestyle aspect of it, is still there. You have to design a system that, assuming people are going to be bad rather than good, I think, given the damage FIFA has had over those years. And I don't think it has done that. That was the other thing that screamed off the page in the FIFA statement. It kind of patted itself on the back for implementing all these reforms from 2016. And in some ways it has, and it does deserve some credit on certain things. For example, there is a greater degree of transparency, whether you like how they arrived at these ethics decisions or the journey of those or any of these disciplinary matters. They're now all published and printed in full on their website. So you can kind of interrogate how a decision came to pass. That wasn't the case before, so that's a good thing. But in terms of the reforms that it was mentioning, Gianni Infantino was actually on the committee when he was at UEFA that helped FIFA devise the reforms. One of the main ones was to try and reduce the power of the president, and it kind of said the president, whoever he or she may be, will kind of be a guiding light, really, someone who would have a strategic vision, and the implementation largely of that would be done by an administrator, a CEO, a secretary general, if you will, who is responsible for the day-to-day management of football. And that really hasn't happened. Gianni Infantino is the executive president of football or FIFA. He is the CEO and the chairman in one person, which is exactly the opposite of what those reforms said. It has allowed Gianni Infantino to accrue so much executive power that he is now trying to shape football in his will and in the way he would want it. And the risk, just to conclude, the risk is that you risk the organisation, really, on the judgment of one person. And that's quite scary, that one person could have that much control of any organisation. And you know, this is something they really do need to figure out.
You said, Tarek, that, you know, that there is a positive in that you can look at how they've arrived at judgments in their ethics committees. And I guess the point is, apart from the two of you, I know very few people who would open that drawer to read that verdict, because we've all got other things to do. So is that part of it, is part of this? And we sort of mention it in the interview with Miguel, and look, this is probably the first time we've really talked about this in a podcast that I've been doing for however many years, that it just isn't, it is hard and it's complicated, and so the scrutiny will be small. And even the people that do scrutinize it aren't given pages and pages of newspapers or hours and hours of podcasts or TV shows, because it's not going to get as many people exercised as whether Thomas Tuchel keeps possession too much for Chelsea.
I would say I'm going to be the devil's advocate here. I think it's actually the to rebound on what Tarek was saying and what you responded, I think it's very important that those decisions are put there out in the open. Because if you say, oh, only a few people read that, it's a bit like saying, oh, there is a Commons Committee which is working on gambling in sport, but their deliberations are kept secret. No, they're not. We can watch that online, and it's part of democracy. You don't want to watch them, that's your problem. But at least as well, if you want to exercise scrutiny as an investigator, as a journalist, as an analyst, a commentator, you now have some more material. And we have had we could have plenty of examples of some of those decisions, which actually, funnily enough, it's a detail that I have to say. The decisions from the investigatory chamber of the Ethics Committee are put out in English, and they're signed by Maria Rojas, who is the head of this independent committee at FIFA. The problem is that she doesn't speak English. When it comes to the scrutiny, I have to say also, Max, we are in a very strange context at the moment, in which there is far less scrutiny because we've got, in a way, far more important matters on our mind. Our editors have got far more important matters on our mind. When we talk about football, perhaps in this age, we'd rather have talk about Jack Harrison's hairdo and Mohamed Salah's goal of genius, you know, rather than talk about issues like this, which seem to darken the mood even more. And I have to say, unfortunately, that it is a context which has been used by some people, I think, to sweep a lot of things under the carpet, because the scrutiny is not there at the moment. And also, it's not sexy. Like, for example, if we're talking, remember all how the spotlight was put on FIFA because of the 2022 World Cup given by to Qatar. There were several good reasons for that. First of all, the decision was completely incomprehensible at the time. Second, it mattered because of the people who lost, i.e. England and the US. England or the United Kingdom, which is basically the basis for sports politics journalism. You know, it's like, I don't know, Tariq, what, 3/4 of the journalists who are really scrutinizing FIFA are actually based in England or write in English. So so because of that, we've distanciated ourselves from governance, which is why it's more important than ever to talk about it, and to talk about it as we're doing it now.
Do you think FIFA would talk to us? I mean, I'm hardly Jeremy Paxman, Tarek, you know. Do you reckon they'd come on?
I think this FIFA probably would, and they'd probably talk a good game as well. What they wouldn't say, and this is where I have a degree of sympathy for them, is that they are basically, their electorate, the people who elect Gianni Infantino, are not the football stakeholders, it's not the fans, it's not the clubs, it's not even Florentino Perez. You know, it's 211 FAs. So this is the structure. You're trying to get votes from 211 FAs, and sadly, a lot of them are as very dodgy, unfortunately, and they still are. So this is your electorate. This is your these are the people who you're trying to get on side every 4 years when you're trying to be re-elected. So privately, if you speak to senior, very senior people at FIFA, they'd like to remove these guys, change the structure, etc., etc. But they're beholden to this system. And to be honest with you, what should have happened in 2015 is that the walls were shaking, but they didn't come down. And that sadly shouldn't have been the case after something as seismic as that those Exco guys being let out of a 5-star hotel in Zurich.
The other problem, structural problem, is that FIFA has the direct executive power to control those MAs through the processes of the so-called independent committees. And one thing we have seen here over the past, four and a half years, is that FIFA is playing with a very heavy hand with some of the MAs, particularly in Africa and the Caribbean. I think if we get the chance at some point, we'll have to talk about what happened in Trinidad in particular, which was a wonderful case study.
Well, look, I think that is enough for you know, I trust most of the listeners have a longer attention span than I do. But you mentioned William, you mentioned the Trinidad situation and Trinidad and Tobago, yeah. And that was William Wallace, who is a guy who won the became the head of the FA in Trinidad and Tobago, perhaps against all the odds. And we've interviewed him already, Philippe. We don't need to, you know, and that will be the part of the next episode of this. Because all we just want is, we just want good people doing good things, don't we, Philippe? That's the dream.
Absolutely.
I think Philippe alluded to a fundamental issue here. There is a direction of travel that could sort of clean some of this up, in my opinion. It's just basically splitting this organisation in two. You've got this money-making World Cup event organiser, possibly a club World Cup organiser, going to generate all of this cash. And then you've got the football policeman, which is the dual role. I don't think one organisation should be doing both things. You can have a governance and stroke policeman role in a separate organisation. And there's no reason why that shouldn't happen. And that should also be responsible for distributing the funds and overseeing that. The moment the problem we've got is that the people who are making the money are also handing it out, and that creates huge conflicts of interest. So you can kind of fix it, perhaps, or one fell swoop. Whether they want to do it, they don't, because it's power and control. So who knows? Maybe if we, after we've gone in the year 2080, when this conversation is happening again, how do we fix FIFA? Someone might think, oh, why don't we split it in two?
Does Philippe, if you talk about FIFA for a certain amount of time, does your cat meow that loudly? Is that?
Yes, it's a bit, you know, there's, I don't know if you've seen Lupin. You know,
no, it's on the
series.
List.
There is a dog in there which barks every time the name of the baddie is quoted, but Pellegrini. So when I say Infantino, you probably will hear one of my cats in the background. Just joking, of course.
Listen, thanks so much for your time, chaps. We'll do it again, no doubt. Philippe, cheers, mate.
Thank you.
Cheers, Tarek.
Thanks, Max.
We'll be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.